Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and...
Jake.
McClure.
All right, we're done for the day.
That's
We've
it.
Said our names.
No, we have to disclose.
Oh, all right.
And disclaim.
What are you claiming that you're going to diss?
I'm going to disclaim any investment advice given on this next 2 hours worth of radio nonsense that we broadcast across the airwaves. And is the internet waves or is it quantum? Is it an internet wave? I mean, airwaves, I understand.
But why would you think that quantum is not a wave?
Well, because quantum is composed of quanta, which are individually measurable particles.
And waves.
Well,
that's the whole concept of string theory.
Well, yes, but string theory is different. We don't know that string theory is working over the internet.
You're correct.
It's
string
still,
theory
it's,
may
it's
not.
It's more of a hypothesis.
We should start a webpage on that.
Yes, we should. So whatever it is that we're broadcasting over, under, around, and or through, this is not investment advice, even though the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of a radio program to which you are listening, or you would not know I was saying this. It is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that gives investment advice and manages money for people in lots of places. But, so those are the two big ones. Information, we should probably say something like, information given in this program has been derived from sources normally deemed to be reliable but is not warranted as to accuracy or completeness. Doesn't that sound cool? Doesn't mean anything.
No, it doesn't sound cool. That you cannot say sound cool saying that. I mean, cool would be...
I can.
Hey, hey. Or what is it Fonzie says? Is it the snap? That's cool.
It is?
Yes. What you just said was what we are, which is...
Not cool.
Kind of the definition.
Well, if you're a geek, it's cool to have lots of big words strung together at the end.
Right.
Anyway, we are here, and we are both certifiable, or certified, as the case may be, to talk about the kind of stuff that we talk about. And if you'd like to give us a call and ask questions or make comments or whatever about something to do with the economy or investing, that's our narrow areas of expertise, you're certainly welcome to do so. And the telephone number is area code 254 and then 773-1400.
Right.
Okay, now we're done and can go home.
Oh, yes. Now we can go home.
Or we just sit here and wait for the telephone to ring.
We may be sitting a long time. They heard our definition of cool, and they may not have enjoyed it.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, I could say a survey of Chinese manufacturing activity rose for the 8th month, while a similar measure in the U.S. hit its highest reading in nearly 3 years, resulting in synchronized developed market and emerging market growth.
Well, okay, let's translate that. What we're seeing kind of across the board in Asia and in the Americas, particularly North America, is manufacturing growth.
Is manufacturing growth?
Yes, not necessarily job growth in manufacturing.
Oh, yeah, and there's a headline article in Barron's. But let's talk about the market.
Yeah, let's do that first.
All right. For the week, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index was up 0.67%, which doesn't sound like much until you think that we're just over 2 months into the year, and the S&P 500 so far is up 6.44%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 6.29% so far this year, and the one-year return from last year when we were convinced that the world was coming to an end because the price of oil was dropping is roughly 20%. It's 19.16 for the S&P 500, 23.51 for the Dow Jones Industrial Average. So in 1 year, we've seen some really substantial gains in the market. But remember, that's because last year at this time, the market had fallen into the proverbial pits.
I want to make a point here. The last three kind of sort of semi-terrifying things that people were scared of in the market all have some similarities.
Well, I know two of them. One of them was a year and a half ago, China was going to implode.
Mm-hmm.
And then about a year ago, the oil market was going to implode and take the entire world down in a great sucking noise into an oil well.
Right.
What was the other one?
Greece. So there's something in common in all of these.
Yeah.
They're all in the kitchen. So if you think about your China exploding or a Greece problem or an oil problem, they're all the same. And I have no idea what that sound is.
Could be our phone ringing.
It is our phone ringing.
It is our phone
ringing.
My goodness. Can you actually hear our phone ringing?
We now know that people are listening. Maybe it's a wrong number.
Yeah, we'll find out. So why don't we answer the telephone?
We're answering the telephone.
And you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Well, good morning. This is Paul. Why don't you guys spend a few moments, any time you got today, and explain Snapchat? How in the world can an IPO like that go out there? I go back. I was in the market in the late 90s, too. I understand some of the IPOs back there. But just kind of explain the mentality behind investors jumping all over Snapchat at the price that it was and the price that it went up to, the valuation that it has compared to other companies, and why it's a good investment.
On that last one, we're going to disclaim right away on that last one, okay?
Listen, okay?
All right, thanks for the call. All right, Snapchat. I'll start it if you want to take over after.
You're welcome to run with it. I'm interested in hearing what you have to say.
Okay, one of my favorite quotes about bull markets and bear markets came from John Templeton, who millennials have no idea who that was. He was one of the greatest investors of the 20th century. Sir John Templeton. He was knighted because of his greatness in investing. He's kind of like the British Warren Buffett. And he said that bull markets are born on pessimism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. Well, we're starting to see the optimism pick up. So the bull market is maturing. Snapchat, we talked about this before the IPO, but it's important to put this in perspective. Snapchat has no earnings. It has no revenue stream. Doesn't know how it's going to get a revenue stream yet. Neither did Facebook. Neither did Twitter when they IPO'd. Facebook found a revenue stream. Twitter did not. So that's a 50-50 just from those two arguments. I'm not recommending either of those positions. Snapchat is also, in its initial public offering, only offering non-voting shares. So you're paying for the right to almost be in a limited partnership as a limited partner. You have no say in who's on the board, no say in the direction of the company whatsoever, and they don't have a revenue stream. So the reality there is that the optimism around Snap is based in rhetoric and hype, which is kind of interesting because we're seeing really good leading indicators in the economy, really, really good indicators that say that the economy is taking off and doing well right now and should, based on these indicators, continue to go well into the next 6 months or year. And the market has taken off a lot more than those indicators should be saying. Not that I think that it's a bad thing that the market's going up, but much of it is based on political rhetoric and an atmosphere of optimism. Your turn.
Snapchat is up because Snapple was up.
And Snapple, like the drink?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you hunt for Snapple, you're going to have a lot of trouble finding it. But you may remember there was a time when there was something called Snapple, and there was a time when Snapple had an IPO, and there was a time when I happened to be pretty much aware of what was going on because they were paying Rush Limbaugh to talk about Snapple, and the more he talked about Snapple, the higher the Snapple stock went, until it was at a point where, in order to justify the price of the stock, every human being in the United States would have to drink about a gallon of Snapple per day to have a reasonable price for the stock. Now, if you hunt around for Snapple today, you're going to have a hard time finding it because it sort of disappeared. And it also started with Snap. So I feel like that we probably can make a comparison there, don't you think?
Yeah.
So this is the point.
They both have Snap in them as well, just like grease, oil, and China are all kitchen stuff. And so all panic should start in the kitchen.
In the short term, the stock market is a casino. In the long term, it's a value measurement. And the question with the casino, it's kind of like if you said red something, I don't know, you know, you bet in a roulette. I don't even know what the things are. You have, you know, it's a number and a color.
Numbers and colors, yes.
And let's say you read red 26 and you won on red 26. Does that mean that everybody should bet on red 26? Does that mean that the roulette wheel is a good place to make a bet? No. But here's what happens.
Let me throw a piece in there.
Okay.
On this. In Vegas and any other gambling facility that has roulette wheels, they will list a bunch of numbers as the past winners. They list them up generally in an electronic format up there next to the wheel saying these are the things that won most recently. And people bet more on those items than on others, as if the chance that the fact that they did win means something for the next time around. It doesn't, but it makes us feel better. So this is really what the question is about. So go ahead.
The issue is that when an IPO comes out and falls, and Snap had an IPO, initial public offering, when it comes out and actually falls, you don't see that in the big headlines. When it comes out and it sells for pretty much what it was offered for,
again, you don't see that in the headlines.
But what you'll find is, if you look at the business model of the company that is making an initial public offering, if it is a very popular consumer company, if it is one widely known by people who know very little about investing, generally speaking, it tends to do very well at the initial public offering and collapse thereafter.
This is an example of that. Who uses Snap? The demographics of the people that use Snap are young, generally people without a whole lot of money. I saw something, major banks investing hundreds of millions of dollars in this IPO. Well, I know why that is. They are speculating that a bunch of ignorant investors are going to jump on board and they'll be able to turn around and sell the stock to those ignorant investors. There's a problem with using that as your philosophy to invest. That's called the greater fool theory, that there is always someone who you can sell the item to who's less informed and less astute than you are, and so you should be able to sell it to them. Well, that only works when there are greater fools out there. You can make a bet that the world is full of greater fools and be the last person to make that bet. And if you're the last person to make that bet, it means that there are no fools left.
There have been, in the last 3 years, about 500 IPOs. And you may note that among the 500 IPOs, how many of them made headlines? And the answer is...
All the ones that are newspaper IPOs. They make headlines kind of by definition.
There are newspaper IPOs? I haven't seen any.
I don't know. If there's 500 of them and you wanted to know which of them made headlines, the company would make headlines for a living. So that's a riddle answer, I think.
When you have 500 public offerings and one of them in the last 3 years makes popular headlines, that gives you some idea of the probabilities that the initial public offerings are going to do well. By the way, one of the things that is really fascinating about initial public offerings is the less well they do early on, the better they tend to do over the long term. So is Snap a good investment? Well, no. And why? Because Snap's not making any money. The number of people who are actually using Snap is not rising. It's actually declining. It's probably a really good deal for the owners of Snap to do their initial public offering right now, because they, in essence, are selling their shares to the public. And the public decided to buy them and in a frenzy bid them up because they're popular. And so Snap, that is just one of those crazy things that happens in the market. And it's a belief, and there's some degree of understandableness, if that's a word, to it. What happens is...
I don't know. If it is, I don't understand it.
Some of the early on, a lot of really serious speculating investors will snap up as fast as they can, because they know that there are so many people out there who follow Snap by definition because they use Snap. Once people see the price going up, there's a tendency to want to go in and buy it because the price is going up, despite the fact that if you look at the price of Snap and you look at Snap's earnings, non-existent, you say, how in the world can we justify buying something that is losing money? Well, you buy it because it's popular, not because it's losing money. And then the initial investors have, in many cases, a window of time they have to hold it. And following that, they will begin to sell. And the art of getting out of making money in Snap would be, A, to have a be able to buy it at the IPO, the initial public offering price, then being able to sell it strategically so as to take advantage of the mania that's going on before reality sets in and the thing falls through the floor. Now, I have no guarantee that Snap is going to fall through the floor as far as price is concerned, but it came to the market at 17, and some serious analysts that I have some respect for are saying it'll end the year at 10. Which will be a 70% loss, not a huge 44 or 54% gain.
I mentioned two other tech companies that had IPOs. One of them was back, I think Twitter's IPO was in right before the recession. I would have to look that up. I know that they started, I guess it was after the recession. So they launched in 2010. So their IPO was sometime after that, and they had a successful IPO. Just like Facebook had a successful IPO. And we warned at the time on both Twitter and Facebook, be careful. They don't have any sources of income yet. They don't know how they're going to make money. They've got a lot of users, but that doesn't mean that they can turn it profitable. Now, Facebook has turned profitable. Whether or not it's worth what people are paying for it now is a different thing.
Well, it came out at 50. That was the IPO.
Twitter?
40.
Yep. 40.
40. Went to 69 almost immediately in 2014. It came out in 2014.
That's the IPO, yeah.
Yes, and is now trading at about $15.75.
So,
that's a typical – that is not at all atypical of some, and I wouldn't be surprised to see Snap do something similar.
It's not atypical. It's not unusual – for a tech company with no revenue stream. So let's take a step back for a second. What is an IPO? Because, I mean, most people know that are listening to this program, but the rest of you that are listening to this program are going, well, I just hope they change the subject soon. An IPO is an initial public offering. It's where they are saying, okay, we are a company, we have shares, we're going to sell them to the public on an exchange. Prior to that, they have to sell only to a small group of people regulatorily. They say this they must be sophisticated, or they must be involved in the running of the business somehow, or basically it's called a closely held company. It's not available for purchase. So when they step out and they say anybody's allowed to buy this, there's a period in there where they have to release a bunch of documents that a lot of the public don't read. If this were not such a sexy thing, and Snapchat basically started out as being it's an imaging and text messaging service that disappears 6 seconds after you receive it. So the vast majority of the stuff that was sent, at least at the beginning, was salacious in nature. It was it's a very sexy IPO. And the people that use it are generally not people that are overly familiar with the market. Well, now it's available for the public to purchase. And the stock price is not priced so high that your general public person cannot afford one or two shares. That's part of the thought that goes into these. The job of the company that is helping Snap come to market, or any company come to market, that job is called an investment bank. And their job is to look over the books, look over the company, see what they own, see what their revenue is, and say this is a fair price for that company per share. When the stock price jumps through the roof or drops through the floor immediately, it means that that company, that investment bank, didn't do a very good job. If they can come to market and say, this is what we believe the company is worth, and then it changes drastically from there, something else was involved in the pricing. When it comes to Snap or any other sexy company, there's been a lot of marketing around this. There have been, and the marketing hasn't necessarily been from Snap. It's from the media talking about Snap as if it's a different kind of IPO. If we, as you were saying, 500 IPOs in the last 3 years, mm-hmm. and we haven't heard much in the way of headlines about them, because Snap is something that is technology.
Well, and so is Twitter.
So is Twitter. So is Facebook.
Well, let's compare it with Twitter for a minute. Twitter's still trading at $15, so if you'd gotten in it right at the beginning at 40, you'd only have lost a little over half your money.
But if you jumped in at the top, 69.
Well, then you would have lost like 3/4 of your money.
Right.
Or something like that.
Well,
anyway,
unless
you're more than 3/4
right,
of your money.
Right. You're saying, well, it'll come back. And it could.
Well, here's the problem. In 2016, its net income, that's its profits, were a negative $456 million.
I don't like negative profits. Negative profits are the ones that foretell doom, by the way. There's two meanings there.
And there's an interesting number if you want to look at Twitter, and you're going to see the same thing, only worse in Snap. And that is that its operating margin, in other words, it sells something. Okay, and margin is, okay, if what is the percentage cost versus sales? In
right.
other words, if I'm selling, if I have something I'm selling for $100 and
it only costs you $50 to make it.
Well, let's say $90.
Okay.
I have a 10% margin.
Right, 10% profit margin.
And that's, I've got to pay taxes on that, and we'll do all other kinds. But still, there's profit there. Now, Twitter is operating vigorously at a negative 15.52% margin. In other words, every time that somebody tweets, Twitter earns revenue of about 15% less than it costs them to transmit the tweet. The Twitter.
I'm not going to say what I tend to call the thing. It's
okay. But anyway,
nice.
Whatever it is, every time the president transmits – Twitter loses 15% on the cost of getting the president's transmissions out to the world.
It's not necessarily the cost of the tweet. It's the cost of running everything that causes the tweet to exist.
But you take the total operating expenses of Twitter and you divide it by the number of tweets. I think that'd be a fascinating thing to do, by the way. You take operating expenses of Twitter divided by the number of
tweets. You
figure
out how much it costs to tweet.
Right.
Yeah, to the company.
And the point is that the company is losing money every time somebody tweets. But the stock is still selling at 15-something a share because people are not very rational. But
well, there's a piece here. They have been in talks with a lot of major corporations to be purchased.
Mm-hmm.
All of them have backed out of the deal. There are no longer any of the major corporations, and there were like seven of them that they were courting to try to get them to buy Twitter. As in, take over the company, buy it all up. And this is a joke, kind of, but it's real. Verizon's still going to buy Yahoo, but they're not going to touch Twitter. That tells you something. Yahoo is working. It's a functional company. It has revenue streams that make sense and real money being made where Twitter doesn't, Snap doesn't. Now, Facebook is an example of how one of these companies came back. And if you think about the way that Facebook makes money, it's something that most of us are annoyed about because when I started Facebook, they didn't have any ads. Now they have ads and they make the businesses pay money to do things, and there's this negativity around that. Well, they're trying to be profitable. I can respect that. They have a service that people enjoy using or enjoy not enjoying using, the people that get on there to complain, which is if you enjoy not enjoying things, then it's very worthwhile for you to do it that way. And it's worth the extra not enjoyment of seeing the advertisements that didn't used to be there. And there are people that enjoy not enjoying things. Facebook has found a way of making money.
Yes.
Will that revenue stream continue? Well, even the people at Facebook think that some new technology is going to come and replace Facebook at some point in the future. That's why they're investing so much of the money that came to them through the stock IPO in other technologies like Oculus Rift and like many other things that they're investing in. It's because they recognize that as a platform, Facebook is as vulnerable as MySpace was. And some people don't remember what MySpace was, but it was the Facebook before Facebook.
Mm-hmm. And so the answer to your question is that there's no shortage of fools in a bull market. We're seeing evidence of that piling up in other directions too. There are
means the bull market is maturing.
Yeah, we've got, in other words, we encounter people who believe because there's a bull market going on that they can invest their own money and do really, really well because they've had some recent experience, particularly since the presidential election, in seeing that whatever it is they invested in went up.
Most things went up.
And the point is, and again, there's a saying, and I think I actually coined this one. I think this is original with me, and that is a bull market makes geniuses out of all of us, but a bear shows us for the fools we really are. And
so we're all genius fools.
Yes, we are. And the issue is that a lot of people are going to invest based on what they see the market doing. That's called speculation.
Spectate.
Over the long term, every study that I've ever read on this, and I've read quite a few very well done studies, indicate that people who do that ultimately lose money. An example, admittedly on a very different scale, is a decade ago, Warren Buffett made a bet with a major hedge fund manager, a $1 million bet, that over the following decade, which will end this year, the original stock market index fund, the S&P 500 index fund at Vanguard, would beat the average return of 10 major hedge funds. $1 million bet, and is absolutely no question at this point who's going to win the bet.
Who? What state was that bet made in?
I don't know. Probably a state of inebriation. But
because the laws of most of the country would make that very illegal.
Well, actually, the way they structured it, it was legal because what happens is it's an agreement between two people that whichever one of them won would contribute $1 million to the other's favorite charity.
Oh, okay. All right.
So there is there was no violation of the gambling laws there. But still, the point is that unless somehow the average of these hedge funds, which, by the way, have never been published, but they're private between the two people, and I don't even know who the bet was made with, but Warren Buffett was on one side of the bet, it's pretty clear that Warren Buffett is going to win. Why is that? Well, because even the best minds and best computer programs that try to beat a well-diversified, well-balanced investment portfolio are being shown in this particular instance over a longer period of time to not be able to do so. Now, we're not recommending you go invest in an index fund. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of ways to do better than an index fund, and a lot of people do better than an index fund. But the point is that high-level speculation, we have this idea that there's some super way to make a lot of money with no risk and get fabulously wealthy in the market for the same reason that people play the lottery. You hear the headlines about, you read the headlines about so-and-so who won the lottery and won umpteen million dollars. What you don't read is the fact that there's multiples of that number of money that were invested in the lottery and lost. There's a prudent way to invest, and there's an imprudent way to invest, and I think it's people really enjoy the imprudent way and the hope and prayer that somehow a lightning bolt will fall out of heaven or something, and they'll become fabulously wealthy.
He made the bet in 2008, and it was a challenge to the hedge fund industry, and Prodigy Partners accepted.
Okay. Right,
and there's... they have the little accents on the E's in Prodigy because
anyway,
why not?
Yeah, and basically at the end of this year, the bet will be fulfilled, but the S&P 500 is far enough now ahead of the average of the 10 hedge funds that it would take something approaching a miracle for the hedge funds to beat the stock market.
I want to make a statement about what was happening 10 years ago today, or roughly 10 years ago today, within a week.
Okay.
Do you have any memory of what was happening 10 years ago?
Probably there were 7 days in the week.
Yeah, they were. There were seven
days.
And
it was chilly in most of the country.
In all of the country of Chile, it was chilly.
No, actually, this is kind of summer in Chile.
But in Chile, it's always chilly.
But I mean, the temperatures were relatively low. Not as low as they are today because this is a warmer – February was warmer. I don't know. Right. What happened 10 years ago?
February 27th, 2007, Freddie Mac released a press release announcing that it would no longer buy the most risky subprime mortgages because they looked risky all of a sudden. In April 10 years ago, so almost 10 years ago, New Century Financial Corporation, the leading subprime lender at the time, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. We're at the 10-year mark of the beginnings of what we now call the Great Recession. 10 years is long enough for a lot of us to have forgotten how to invest to avoid risky things. Now, there's some risk in investing across the board. I mean, companies fail.
You probably shouldn't invest across the board.
No. That probably boards shouldn't be involved at all.
Unless you're board certified.
Right. The concept that we're dealing with now, we just spent a lot of time talking about the Snap IPO. After the market crash, and the crash was a very sustained long-term crash. It wasn't a one-day event. It was a long-term kind of slow motion train crash of the market. And we had a recovery beginning in 2009. Well, 2009 to 2007, we're dealing with an 8-year period here, which is long enough for people to have forgotten the dangers associated with jumping into things unless you really understand what you're jumping into. Keep it in mind, even in the up markets. Come on, guys, we earned that experience. The hard knock degree came to us all if you were around the market during that time period. And what I can tell you with a great deal of assurance going forward into the future is that we will have market downturns. This is a good period, and it's a happy period, and people talk about how optimistic we are. We still are optimistic. We're optimistic about the economy, but this market that we're seeing, the run-up that we're seeing here, is too much too fast. It's not based in the leading indicators that we're looking at, which are mildly positive. Not hype it up and make it really, really positive, but mildly positive. We are experiencing a market based on hope, and that is fantastic if those hopes are met. But some of the hopes that this market is based in don't have a chance of hitting fruition. One of the hopes is that somehow Congress will work nicely together with itself and do things quickly and easily. Well, that's an oxymoron. Congress doesn't do that. So we may get all the things that we're hoping for, except for the timeline. If we get regulatory reform, if we get tax reform, we're talking about a 2 or a 3 or a 4 year period over which this is going to happen.
There's an interesting point here too that and we're not – I don't want to switch from being unduly optimistic to unduly pessimistic.
I agree.
But I want to post a warning. Now, there's a couple of things going on out there, and we need to do some commercials too. There's a couple of things going on that are really important, and we'll get do some details on this. But the manufacturing index is up. It's the ISM, which is the index we look at, is at 57 point something. Anything above 50 indicates growth. But this is from the purchase managers. That's from the Institute for Supply Management. That's the ISM. The manufacturing index is basically talking to the managers and saying, are you seeing a lot of orders coming in? Do you anticipate a lot of things happening in the future? It's not solid numbers. It's anticipation.
Right.
Now
they're looking at the trends that are going on right now and pushing them into the future a little bit.
But what we didn't see last month, now we don't have the data for February yet, it won't for a little while, is we didn't see consumer spending go up significantly. We didn't see auto sales go up significantly. We saw second resales of homes go up, but not, and they did go up very nicely, but the point is that's not a big deal. Selling of new homes is a big deal. So we're not actually seeing the things in the economy that would create the level of growth that the stock market is anticipating right now. What we are seeing is the opinion of a lot of people is that things will get better in the future. Now, that tends to be self-fulfilling, but here's the problem. The president made a great speech on Tuesday night. The stock market jumped on Wednesday. But if you listen to what he didn't say, there are three legs that the investors and people in business are depending on to see a big growth in the economy. A cut in taxes,
mm-hmm.
an increase
– corporate and
individual,
personal.
Right. And dramatic increase in federal spending,
mm-hmm.
and deregulation.
Yep.
If you'll notice during the president's speech, he didn't mention deregulation except in passing. Dodd-Frank, you're going to dismantle Dodd-Frank, which will unleash the power of corporations to make money again, except for the fact it's not even on the horizon in Congress at this point.
Yeah.
Because they're first trying to figure out how to dismantle
Obamacare.
Now, frankly, whether you like Obamacare or don't like Obamacare, if you crush Obamacare, if you were just simply to eliminate it right now, economically, it would be very damaging to the country.
Yeah, and just a quick analogy of that. If you think of the economy as an engine, and someone developed a part, and you could love that part or hate that part, doesn't matter. The part is now in the engine. Pulling that part out of the engine is going to have an impact somewhere on the rest right. of the engine. So we have to be careful about that. It doesn't matter if it's a better part than the one before or the new part's going to be better than that. Mm-hmm. The engine has to be running when we replace the part.
And the reason I say that, there's a lot of underlying reasons, but without there's nothing political about it. It's simply that if you look at healthcare stocks, you'll see that they're kind of shaky right now, and they're really shaky for a good reason.
There's some medicine they can take for that.
No, I don't
shakiness
think,
in the healthcare world. Well,
yeah, the problem is that we got – you know, roughly 22, last estimate I read, 22 million people with health insurance, and the health insurance is causing those people to actually go see the doctor and go to the hospital and get operations. And the hospitals and the doctors and the medical organizations and the drug organizations, all that, get paid for that because those 22 million people have health insurance. You yank their health insurance. Does that mean they're going to stop going into the emergency room or stop getting their operations? No, they'll maybe get them a little later, but they won't pay for them.
And they'll be more expensive because they waited later to do them.
Right. And an end result of that is that it would be damaging to a big sector of our economy because there simply won't be the money coming in to that sector of the economy that was before. There's a lot more ramifications to it than that, I can tell you. But yeah,
we've got commercials that we have to play here.
So the number one priority of Congress is to do something that would damage the economy with nothing to carry it forward.
You're right. If they come up with something to replace it, even if it's something that's not very good, at least it yeah. would be something.
But they can't agree on that, right?
Right. And that's the issue. So that that's what we mean when we talk about rhetoric and hype. Until we get some real policies, some real action, the guesswork that's going on in the market can be dangerous, particularly if people are jumping in thinking this is the new normal.
And
new normal is the same as the old normal, which is volatility is the normal. You're going to see ups and downs in the market.
Let me throw one comment in here. There is an underlying growth in the economy going on that has nothing to do with the rhetoric. The market is not terribly out of position for that, but it could be subject to a real hurt if everything doesn't work out, because there's so much of it that is based on good feeling, and we got to do commercials.
Yes, we'll be back on the other end. If you'd like to join us with the Personal Wealth Coach, the number to call in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number's in here. Telephone number in here, 773-1400. Of course, the local area code 254-773-1400. I want to emphasize, we are not down on the agenda that President Trump has brought to Congress of deregulation, lowering corporate taxes, and finding another way to get revenue. The issue is, so far, we don't have anything solid to work with. And we're just advising people to move forward with caution, because very much like the Snap IPO, there's a lot of speculative money in the market right now. And a lot of it, matter of fact, the major inflow over the last several weeks into the market has not been professional investors. It has been from index S&P 500 fund ETFs.
Yeah, and this is...
which indicates it is people who really don't understand very much about what's going on buying a bunch of stuff in the market.
Right, and let me say this clearly as well. A lot of money over the last decade has been building up. The cash has been filling up on the sidelines. We've talked about that as being a potential input into the market, causing a great deal of upward movement. The important thing to realize is that cash seems to be moving into the market now. Who's in control of the cash is very important. We've had something very strange over the past year or so, which is a lack of major volatility. We had one downturn back in February, but mostly if you look at the amount, the point rise or drop in any given day, it hasn't been dramatic until after the presidency, after the election, and then we've seen these dramatic upward jumps. Be aware that those dramatic upward jumps are the same people making those purchases are the ones that will be making the dramatic downward falls, because they'll be doing the sell for the same reason that they're making the buy, which is they're making a buy because they feel good about something. They will make the sell because they feel bad about something. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the definition of an amateur investor. That's whose money is coming into the market right now. So expect something we haven't seen for a year. Expect volatility. And when it starts is up in the air. People talk about us being optimistic. We've been warning about the bond market for a long time. We see the stock market as a very rational place to be based on the economy going forward. What we're seeing right now is a lot of people with no experience and a high likelihood of being out as soon as they're in, jumping out of the market for the same reason that they're jumping into the market. That means we should expect volatility going forward. I think the majority of the people that listen to our program are long-term investors. What we're saying to you, if you're a long-term investor, is expect some volatility. I don't see any problem for the American society, economy, our whole concept of what we are going forward into the future at this point. So long-term investing is still, my opinion, is still the way to go. Short term, don't get scared, and this is the harder one, don't get overly euphoric about the upturns in the market, because if we've learned anything, anybody that's been in the market through the Great Recession, if you've learned anything, it's that markets drop. Long term, historically, they're way up. But the price you pay for that, in academia, they call it risk premium. The premium that you're getting paid for the risk that you're taking in the short run. Recognize that. Don't go in with your eyes closed. Know that it exists. Don't go in with rose-colored glasses. You can have your eyes open and have the wrong color glasses on, by the way. That's just something you should check the color of your glasses regularly.
Before you close your eyes.
Yes, before closing your eyes, check the color of your glasses.
And again, I want to emphasize something here. We are still long-term optimistic about the markets. We're still long-term optimistic about the United States economy. I guess our concern is that we're seeing some evidence of something that people may be disappointed in the future. Let me give you an example. There have been more than a few economists who've looked really, really hard at the most optimistic outcome of deregulation, tax cuts, and increased infrastructure spending.
That's short-term, really, really good for the economy.
Right. Here's the problem. You won't see, under the best-case scenario, it would be late 2018 before corporate earnings and profits actually showed a result based on an action. If the Congress took the action in the next couple of weeks and the president signed it, and all of the changes that somebody or anybody envisioned, although I must admit the changes are contradictory at this point, were to be put into place, it would show up in corporate earnings not this year, but late next year. Now, and if it takes them 6 months or a year to enact these changes, then it will be 2019 or 2020. And very realistically, the big economic effect of anything that's going to be done by Congress and the president is going to appear sometime around 2020.
Right. And that's in taxes. When we're talking about the infrastructure spending, which is a big thing, it's a really important thing. Barack Obama, when he did the same thing, when he pushed forward this big infrastructure thing, you know, some of you may remember shovel-ready projects only. 6 years. That's longer than one term of presidency, which means this is an if, not a prediction. If Trump is not reelected, some of his statements about what he wants done today, if Congress acts on them and the infrastructure spending goes and we get the boost to the economy in 6 years, whomever is president at that point gets to take the credit. This is why we say that the presidents rarely have an impact immediately on any economy, because it takes so long for the system to get involved, which is, again, why we're saying this big run-up in the market so fast right now, we should see some downturns. This may be a long-term, a really fair market value, but expect some downturns between now and then, just out there. Making it known. We're about out of time for this hour. We'll be back next hour. If you'd like to join us here in the studio, you can call 254-773-1400, and we will put you on the air. If you'd like to call us off the air and get us to get you some personalized advice as fiduciaries, you can call our voicemail during the week, or during the weekend, and real live people during the week locally at
254-947-1111.
And you can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We should have some good updates to that going forward into the future. Now we have our philosophy up there. You can look at our team. You can look at who we are and what we do. We've got podcasts of this program going back quite a ways. You can listen to what we said about any predictions. They're on the web, so you can listen to them and hold us accountable, although that is rarely done to people that make predictions. Holding accountable is a little bit odd. You can email us directly, and we use those emails for the next program that we do. When people ask us questions about things in the economy, we use those. So Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com. We really appreciate the feedback, by the way. So thank you for listening. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. We'll be back next hour with more.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.